Hey, good morning, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. My name is Leah M., recovered compulsive overeater from New Jersey and your moderator for today. Today is Sunday, July 6, 2025. The share ID numbers for Friday, July 4th, are the following. For the 10 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 22,577. That's 22577. And for the 10 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 22,578. That's 22578. This morning, A Vision for You presents From Entitlement to Surrender, Finding Humility in Recovery. Our disease of compulsive overeating and the way we manage our own lives brings us to the end of our rope. Our ways and our efforts have failed us. Even when we thought we knew best, we were often proven wrong in spite of our self-knowledge, our self-sufficiency, our perceived entitlement. We are the architects of our own misery. We suffer with the juggernaut of self-will, and we suffer, and we suffer until we have suffered enough to the point of surrender and to be willing to look for something better. What is that something better? The Big Book tells us. This is the how and why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. We could no longer insist on having our own way, on trying to control other people, on believing that we always know what's best for ourselves, for the world, and for everyone else. We had to develop humility. In order to do that, we had to be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. The 12 steps, as outlined in the Big Book, represent a process resulting in a spiritual awakening, a deep and lasting personal transformation. The actual solution to the problem of unmanageability is finding and establishing a relationship with power through the application of the 12 steps. We are taken from the world of self-will, entitlement, and self-reliance to a path of humility and God-reliance. Joining us today to speak on finding humility in recovery is Jessica C., a recovered compulsive overeater from Canada. Jessica is devoted to living our 12-step way of life and to carrying the message of recovery. It's with great appreciation that I welcome Jessica C. to the line this morning. Good morning, Jessica.
Hi, good morning, Leah. Can I still be heard okay?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, okay, great. Wow, thank you for that incredible opening. I am Jessica C., recovered compulsive eater. I live in Ontario, Canada. More specifically, I live about an hour and a half drive north of the city of Toronto. I'm super nervous. I'm going to humbly admit that. I've been in OA for a long time, for 20 years, but I, you know, stepped away at one point, which I'll get into more detail about. But I came back about 4.5 years ago, and it was these special editions that really drew me in, that I, you know, that I listened to. And I remember hearing someone deliver a special edition who lived not far from me. And I just helped me feel more at home and just more willing to really throw myself into this program, which I really needed to do. I was so desperate at that time. So I do want to talk about how a deep feeling of pride and lack of humility was at the core of my disease of compulsive eating. And I do want to talk about how God granted me the miracle of removing my compulsive eating and reducing a lot of my pride and entitlement. I do want to say I'm not an expert in the Big Book or in AA literature. One way that my lack of humility can show up is always needing to seem really competent or as an expert in something. I'm definitely not an expert in the Big Book, though I am learning a lot every day through this daily meeting. I'm definitely an expert in compulsive overeating and what it's like to live a life full of veiled pride and self-centeredness. So it does say on in the Big Book on page 62 that selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. And that's absolutely true for me. And I really relate to something that I heard an AA speaker say recently, where he described himself as someone who has a preponderance towards self-involvement. Yeah, that is true for me, and definitely true for me when I was actively compulsively overeating. I was just so absorbed in myself, in the fears, the chronic fear that I would feel, in always seeking validation. And they're just like that really just dominated my thinking, and there just wasn't room for God to get through to me. The same page in the Big Book, it says, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. So my manifestation of lack of humility, isn't always obvious, and it's more of a, I guess, a quiet form of entitlement. I'm not someone who overtly would brag or boast, but inside I carried a really deep self-pity, and this sense that I was entitled to more than what God had given me. And I lived in a lot of fantasy, a very active fantasy life, and grandiosity. You know, the disease just is so big and pervasive, and it can just show up in a lot of different ways. So I'll do my best to share what I've learned about humility through the Big Book. And I'll also reference the AA 12 and 12, and especially through my own experience. You might hear me say some things that you've heard before. I've shared on this line by other people. I've learned so much from the other people on this daily meeting. And I hope that I can bring these gems of wisdom together in a way that really shines a light on the hope that the 12 steps has to offer and a relationship with God has to offer. I'll qualify. So I think I was a compulsive overeater from a really young age. I just remember being obsessed with certain foods from a really young age. I remember, you know, knowing that relatives were going to visit and just being so excited that they were going to be bringing, you know, a certain type of cheese with them. That's what I was excited about, was the food that they would be bringing. So I started to gain weight, and it was around the age of 9 where I realized that I was heavier than most of the other kids that I knew. And I started to feel a lot of shame about my body. All I wanted was to look like the other girls my age and be able to wear a bathing suit and not feel ashamed. But I just fantasized about having that one day. But that did not stop me from eating in a way that caused me to continue to gain weight. So, you know, I was definitely overweight as a teenager. And I went on my first diet when I was 15. I went to my family doctor and told him I wanted to lose weight. And that was the first time I heard about OA. And I really think that this was the first time that God was trying to get through to me. So this was in the mid 90s, 1990s, and my family doctor gave me some OA literature, and I could tell that he had had this literature for a long, long time because the design and the color scheme were from of the literature was from the 1970s. I could just tell that it was old. Like it was those 70s colors, like avocado green and harvest gold. And you know, it just didn't interest me at the time, but I just think about that miracle. Like some OA meeting had some person in OA had took it upon themselves to deliver OA literature to family doctors in the rural area that I lived. Who knows when they did that? And the doctor held on to that literature for who knows how long and gave it to me. And that was the only way I'd ever heard about OA. And somehow that message got through to me. I just think that's such a miracle, that, you know, like we hear shared on this meeting that God does send out search and rescue missions. And that was the first of many for me. But yeah, OA was not, it just wasn't what I was looking for at that time. And, you know, even then, my sense of entitlement was already pretty established. I definitely remember feeling like God had abandoned me, that God had denied me, you know, the body that I wanted. You know, I saw other girls my age getting attention for their looks, having more popularity, having more, you know, material wealth, having talent that I wanted, and just having this feeling of like envy and just being upset with God that I hadn't been given these things. And yeah, and it was true that, you know, other people had more of these qualities and material possessions that I wanted, but it's also true that my appetite for all of these things, for the attention, admiration, for food was bottomless. Like I wanted more. I believe I wanted these things more than how much other people wanted them. And I know that was true because if I would get something that I wanted, if I would get some praise at school, for example, or a compliment, you know, that satisfaction that I would feel was so fleeting. And I always needed more. And my attention was always back on, well, why don't I have what she has? You know, even though I got some of what I wanted, or maybe even a lot of what I wanted, it wasn't very long before I was feeling, you know, that entitlement again. So I really relate to what it says on in the AA 12 and 12 on page 71, where it says, for thousands of years, we had been demanding more than our share of security, prestige, and romance. Never was there enough of what we thought we wanted. Again, that's just that sort of bottomless need. For validation, you know, material success and so on. And so I guess I tried to give these things to myself through a very active fantasy life. And, you know, food really fueled those fantasies, you know, and imagining that I would just be famous one day. Even though I didn't really have any particular talents that would lead to that, you know, fantasizing that I would like marry a famous celebrity. I mean, it's kind of embarrassing to admit these things, but I mean that is the truth. That is absolutely the truth. And I would definitely binge eat while engaging in this fantasy life. Yeah, so and I, you know, I really relate to Bill's story where Bill talks about this, where he would imagine himself at the head of vast enterprises. And I guess maybe that's not unusual for someone when they're a kid or a teenager to imagine these, a future like this for themselves, or these have these sorts of fantasies. But I think most people grow out of that, and or they get tempered over time, really tempered. Mine perhaps got a little tempered, but I still carried this sense that I should be extraordinary into adulthood. And when that didn't happen, I really felt disappointment and resentment, and I ate to sate those feelings. And, you know, when I was growing up and even into adulthood, I resented my parents, my family, for not being the family or the parents that I saw on TV or that I imagined that my friends had. And yeah, there was, you know, there was dysfunction in my home when I was growing up. There was alcoholism, but I do see that what my parents gave us for the most part was what we really needed. Like, we were raised with strong values and hard work, and what we were given, the material things that we truly, truly needed. And I am grateful for my parents, who have nine children. Both of them like grew up without having a bed of their own or indoor plumbing. And I mean, they gave us so much more than that. And I'm just glad God has changed my perspective in that area. But yeah, so, you know, sort of carrying on with my story, I did lose weight in high school. I went on my first diet. I lost some weight. Life got better. You know, I got some of the things that I wanted. I got a boyfriend. I went away to university, far from home. And, you know, that my disease started to escalate was when I went away to university. I went and took a very competitive program, and I wasn't special anymore. You know, surrounded by people who were more educated, smarter, more cultured, wealthy, more worldly, spoke multiple languages. Like, I just didn't have any of that background or experience. And, you know, I went from being someone who was really good sort of academically to feeling like I was worthless. And I guess that's the flip side of entitlement and pride, is, at least for me, when it gets punctured, I don't just drop down a peg or two in my esteem. I drop down to the bottom and I feel worthless. Like, it's very dramatic for me. And yeah, like I said, that's when the compulsive eating really escalated. You know, I had created these rules around food when I first lost weight in high school, that I started to break. You know, I started eating things like chocolate bars, cookies, candy, all of these things that I for the most part gave up when I first lost weight. You know, I started to eat those things again, and I started to gain weight, and I tried a geographic cure. I moved back home from, you know, where I went away to school. Then I moved to Toronto. I lived in Toronto for 2 years in my early 20s, and I moved 5 times. So yeah, the unmanageability was getting worse. The eating was getting worse. The fantasizing was again getting worse. Like, I just had so much anguish about how my life wasn't going the way that I wanted, and I didn't really know what was wrong. So I just escaped through this fantasy life, you know, again, dreaming about celebrity romances, or just having this life that was extraordinary in some way. I just didn't want to have an ordinary life. That just seems so, like, I just couldn't accept that. Yeah, and, you know, my friends at this point were getting married, having families, and I hadn't had a long-term relationship in years, and my eating was getting more and more out of control. You know, at this time, I thought that my problem was anxiety and depression. That's how I labeled it. Like, that was sort of the labels that I had that I was aware of. And so I thought that was my problem, and my eating was a symptom of that. So I tried counseling and I tried medication, but nothing really helped. At least with my compulsive eating. I knew something was really wrong. I just didn't know what. And, I remember I was trying Weight Watchers again, and I had bought this package of Weight Watchers meetings where if you could buy them in bulk, you would save money. And I knew it wasn't working. And I went to this Weight Watchers meeting and I tried to return the package of meetings and get some money back. And the person there, the employee, was like, well, what's wrong? And I just said, I said to her, I'm like, I don't know what's wrong, but I know that this isn't working for me. And she could see how just desperate I was. And she didn't try to sell me on staying in Weight Watchers. She just said, I really hope you find help. This was when I found my way to OA. I was working back at home in a health food store, binging on, there's lots of unhealthy food in health food stores. I was binging on it. And I suddenly had the memory of my doctor giving me those OA pamphlets back, 10 years earlier. And that idea just came out of nowhere. And I really believe, again, that was another attempt from God to another search and rescue attempt. So I found a meeting, in the town that I lived in, and I found people who described doing with food what I was doing, and it was a relief. It was a relief to find other people who had my disease, and that there was like a format and a solution available. And I like that it talked about God, because I knew at this point my problem was so big that I needed something huge to help me. And I began to have, short stints of what I called abstinence, but I was really still engaging in a lot of alcoholic foods and compulsive behaviors with food. The meetings didn't have a lot of recovery in them, but I did see examples of what real recovery looked like. I saw it in a few people from time to time, people who really, they usually talked about the big book. They had weight loss, they had peace, but I could see that they did a lot of things that I was not willing to do at that time. So I actually got kind of spooked when I met people like this, because I wanted an easier, softer way. I can't really blame the meetings or the culture of the OA that I found at that time, because I could have asked one of those recovered people, I guess they were recovered, to be my sponsor or to model my recovery after theirs. But the truth, again, was that I didn't want to do everything that they were doing, and I didn't want to give up all of the fun that I was still getting on some level from food. And I guess that's another way that my lack of humility showed up, is I thought I could do half measures, a half measure version of the program, and still get the results. I guess I thought I wasn't as bad as some of the people that I encountered were when it came to compulsive eating, or I thought I was different. I was getting shorter stints of abstinence. Maybe they would last a year or 2 years, but then those periods again of abstinence, I'm doing air quotes, started to get shorter, and I started to relapse more often, and the relapses got worse. I started to have some pretty intense relapses. I was gaining all the weight back that I had lost in my earlier years of OA, and, at that time was carrying around 50 extra pounds on my body. And I was doing things with food that I hadn't ever done before. I was like, spending entire weekends by myself, just eating the entire weekend and gaining so much weight that I had to go out and buy new clothes to wear on Sunday night so that I had something to wear when I went to work, because nothing that I had fit me. And that's when I went to my family doctor, and I told him what was going on with food, and he suggested that I try a medication which had recently been approved for binge eating. And this medication is mostly used by people with ADHD, but had, like I said, had been approved for compulsive eating, for binge eating. And, you know, this is a medication that is safely used by lots of people who have ADHD. And maybe it is used safely by people as an appetite suppressant. But I knew that this was a bad idea for me. I knew enough about addiction at this point that this was probably a bad idea for me, but I wanted an easier, softer way, and I took it. And yeah, that became a whole other problem for me. I began to abuse that medication almost immediately after I started taking it. I liked the way that it made me feel. It made me more extroverted and productive. Like, it changed my personality in ways that I really liked. It made me a superstar at work. And I really craved the reaction that I got from people when I was on it, because I was more animated, more fun, more funny. At least in my mind, you know, I was all those things. And, you know, when I would take that medication at an early part of the day, it removed my food cravings, but it would wear off in the late afternoon, and my binges really escalated even further. They became worse than ever before. And now I had, you know, another secret. Not was I only addicted to food, but I was addicted to this drug. And that is what led me to my bottom. Like I said, I was abusing it. It's a stimulant. So it sped up my heart rate, increased my blood pressure. And when I would, when I would take a large dose of this medication and I felt like my heart was racing really fast, I would go to my pharmacy and I would check my blood pressure in the, like, blood pressure machines that they have at most drugstores. But then the pandemic hit and all of those blood pressure machines available to the public were shut down. So I couldn't check my blood pressure anymore. And I started to wonder if I was going to give myself a heart attack. So that happened one day. This was at around the beginning of the pandemic, and I had taken a large dose of this medication. I went to the hospital. I went to the emergency room, and this was, you know, when it was early in during COVID, and, you know, there's people around me in the waiting room describing symptoms that sounded like COVID. And I just thought to myself, like, what am I doing here? And I remember telling the nurses, you know, what medication I was on and the way that they looked at me. And that was a moment where I was like, what am I doing to myself? And again, the reason I took that medication, it wasn't working. My binges were getting worse. I, by this point, had met the man who had become my husband. We were living together, and he would catch me in the middle of the night, you know, binging on his crunchy popcorn and his potato chips because I couldn't sleep, because I was so taken so much of this amphetamine. And so I would try to put myself back to sleep by eating a huge amount of food and putting myself in a food coma. And you would think that that trip to the hospital would have been my bottom, but it wasn't. That a few months later, where again, there was another night where I couldn't sleep. And, you know, I was doing things like taking NyQuil to try to make myself sleep. And again, trying to put myself to sleep by eating huge amounts of food. And my husband caught me doing this. And he caught me flushing all of the pills of this medication down the toilet. And I said to him, like, I have to stop doing this. And that was it. That was the end. And, you know, shortly after that, I threw myself with abandon into working this OA 12-step program. And I heard someone share recently on this meeting that they're grateful that God gave them a bottom That really resonated with me because I could still be doing all of that, all of what I just described in some form or fashion, but God gave me a bottom. It was really painful, but it made me willing to, again, like I said, throw myself with abandon into this program because God had been talking to me for years, you know, every morning during that period, that 2.5 year period of abusing that medication and continuing to abuse food. Every morning, God would whisper to me, he would say, you have to stop. And every morning I pushed that voice aside. I really tried to push that voice aside. But God didn't give up on me. You know, he kept sending search and rescue missions. And I finally decided to surrender to the help that God was offering me, which God continues to offer me and which, you know, continues to be this big book focused OA program. So I came back to OA. This was at the start of 2021. And I called someone who became my sponsor at that time. And she was one of those people who I used to back away from, you know, who I used to avoid because I didn't want to do everything that they were doing. And I remember, you know, I'd left OA when I was taking that medication. And I asked her, I asked this person at that time, like, I told her what I wanted to do. I said, I wanted to try this medication. And she said, okay, you know, maybe that will work for you. And if it does, like, that's great. But if you ever want to come back, you can call me. And if you don't want to come back, but you still want to be friends, like, call me anyway. And that really reminds me of the spirit of the Working with Others chapter, where we don't chase people who aren't sure if they want this program. You know, we maintain good relationships with everyone, whether or not they choose to be in OA. So this time around, you know, I finally got completely honest about all of my alcoholic foods and behaviors. I created a plan of eating with a nutritionist. I did all the things that, you know, we're told to do. I worked the steps quickly. And I started to talk to God, and I started spending deliberate time with God, even if I wasn't sure it would help. I wasn't sure it would help, but I had, you know, no other options left. And, you know, I really love the analogy in the big book about the Wright brothers, where they were told by, you know, the scientific minds at the time that they couldn't fly. You know, I had thought for decades that I would never be free from compulsive eating or this inner anguish that I carried around with me because I had never really experienced freedom from these things. So because it had never happened, I doubted that it would ever happen. In the big book, it does talk about, like I said, how the best scientific minds at the time told the Wright brothers that it was impossible for man to fly, and that earthly reason and the data available at that time didn't support the belief that man could fly. But the Wright brothers chose to believe that it was possible that man could fly. And, you know, that was the mainspring of that of their accomplishment. And again, that just gave me so much hope that just because something had never happened before doesn't mean that it wouldn't happen. When I came back to OA, I chose to believe very imperfectly that maybe God could help me. Again, even if it seemed like he had never helped me before. And when I worked steps 2 and 3, especially, I did begin to experience God's grace. And the first sign of that grace was the lifting of the food obsession. When I was in the food, I work from home. So when I was in the food, what I would do every day in the afternoon is I would leave my house. I would go and get, you know, ice cream and cookies during my workday. It's like it happened every day. Like it's just, I didn't see a way to stop doing that every day. But I remember working the steps and during this last recovery, and it was during step 9 where that idea to leave my house, get the ice cream and the cookies, it just left me. It wasn't that I managed that impulse better. The idea, it's like it had just been sort of cut out of my psyche. And you know, humility, it's something that I really started practicing through steps 6 and 7, especially in areas like my work, where I have experienced chronic fear about my job and being good enough. And when I examined that closer through inventory work, I saw that there was a lot of entitlement under that fear. The truth was, is I didn't want to work that hard. I didn't want to ask for help. I didn't want to seem like I didn't know the answers. I wanted things to come easily. And when they didn't come easily, I got really scared. And, you know, perfectionism for me is at the root of this habit of backing away from anything that seemed too hard. If I didn't think something would be a raging success, I didn't want to do it. And a couple of years ago, I did a 10 step with a fellow about my fear around work. And that was really a pivot point for me. And that fellow said to me, he said that avoiding tasks out of wanting them to be perfect is a form of blocking God, that God doesn't want me to live in fear, that I cannot be of service to others if I am stuck in fear. And I used to feel like such a fraud. I thought that having low confidence at work was just like part of who I am. Like that's just part of my personality. But through that step work, I saw the truth. And it was that my inaction, my procrastination, entitlement, feeling like things have to be perfect, it really fueled that low confidence. And I have more confidence today because for the most part, I don't avoid and procrastinate. And I take action, especially when I'm afraid. And you know, in step 6, the action I need to take is the opposite of the fear, and that's to practicing courage. You know, doing the thing that I'm afraid of, letting it be imperfect, allowing myself to make mistakes, you know, sitting in the discomfort. And it's true that the fear has greatly dissipated over time, that chronic fear that I thought was my constant companion. And, you know, today with my job, you know, I don't complete my work tasks as much for the praise. I'd be lying if I said I didn't. I didn't like it when, you know, I get praise at work. But again, that approach does come with so much fear, because if I don't get the accolades, then I'm afraid and I'm back in self. And I think, what did I do wrong? I do go to God now more for my worth. And, you know, my job today is to be helpful and useful, and not so much to look good. And again, when I do that, the fear is much, much quieter. So one area that I wanted to mention where I am still learning humility, one relationship where I'm still learning humility, is with my mother-in-law. I met my husband in 2019. We've been married for about since 2022. And, you know, with my mother-in-law, I have assigned a role to her, and it's one that she is not playing. I'm playing the director with her, and she's often doesn't play the role that I would like her to play. I guess I came in with this very specific idea of who she should be, what she should be like. And, you know, she's not a perfect person either, but the expectations I can still carry about her, these are not reasonable expectations. I want her to treat me like I'm her own daughter and behave by my rules. And, you know, constantly, I want her to boost my ego. My mother-in-law is a lovely, lovely person. She just doesn't do all of these things. And so I can get triggered. And even with a lot of step work and even with a lot of prayer in this area, you know, I still have some deeply rooted entitlement, and I can struggle. And then I think, like, what's wrong with me? You know, why even with all this step work and bringing God in, why do I still feel this way? But step seven reminds me that when I humbly ask God to remove my shortcomings, it doesn't mean that they go away instantly or on my timeline. And I was talking to my dear sponsor about this last week, about my challenges in this relationship. And what came out of that conversation with my sponsor is that it's pride to think that I should be done with this by now, because that means that I think that I'm the one doing the work, driving the outcome, and not God. When I do ask God to help me love my mother-in-law and to focus on her good qualities, something shifts. So that is my footwork, is to ask God for help, do my best to focus my mind on her good qualities. But this is a tough area for me, and I have to keep surrendering. And that brings a lot of the humility that I really need. I was listening to some AA speakers last week. It was actually Joe said that when God removes a defect, God replaces it with something better. So, you know, what's replacing my pride, humility, and my entitlement? And I find that I do have a lot less interest in my little plans and designs. And for me, that's less need for distraction. I can still do this, but not as much, but definitely not as much. But I can get really absorbed in absorbing information. So reading a lot of books, listening to the news, paying attention to the news, documentaries about different topics, podcasts about different topics, so that I can feel like I'm an expert in all of these topics, and then regurgitate the information to other people and, you know, feel smart and have people tell me that I know so much. But, you know, activities don't give me the same effect now. I'm really much, much less interested in doing that. And that's a miracle, because that really defined my identity for a long time. And I think that God is creating, I think that it's a little bit destabilizing, actually, to be honest with you, because I'm sort of like, well, what do I do with this extra mind space and just time? And I think that God is actually creating space in my life, space for me to connect with God and talk to God, instead of always listening to something or reading something, and just having more time and energy to be helpful and useful to others. And I don't have that same inner anguish. So I have less of a need to numb out with anything. Again, that's just such a miracle. And, you know, I'm more available now, more helpful and useful. And I really enjoy sponsoring. You know, for years in OA, I didn't sponsor. I wanted people to sponsor me and give me their time and energy, but I was aghast when anyone suggested that I do the same for someone else. And, you know, I also didn't think I had much to offer. So again, there were those two, that's again, that shadow side of lack of humility, is not wanting to give, but then also thinking I was worthless and didn't have anything to give. So I don't need, you know, that polished exterior as much today. And it's really nice to not feel the burden of having to be perfect. And, you know, last year I met a fellow who I really admire her recovery. And she said something to me that kind of rocked me. She said, you know, you could be a more joyful person. She said that to me. And yeah, it kind of hit me like a ton of bricks. But she did me a service by saying that to me. You know, she told me the truth. And so I think that nowadays God is slowly unpacking these old ways of being that sapped my joy. The idea, you know, these ideas that satisfaction comes from hoarding my time or earning praise or trying to be impressive. And, you know, I think another thing that sapped my joy is this deep sadness that I had, that I think that God abandoned me, that he didn't help me with my eating. that God showered blessings on others but didn't give me what I felt I deserved. So again, entitlement really robbed me of my joy for a long time. And I think that nowadays I'm slowly getting that joy back. And I get and I feel that joy by being useful. And there is a lot of joy in knowing that my prayers are slowly being answered. And God is answering those prayers by removing my compulsive eating. I'm very neutral with food and that chronic dissatisfaction that I felt for most of my adult life. And, you know, God led me to my husband, you know, the man of my dreams, you know, who loved me at my absolute lowest. Before I met him, I mean, I could not pick, all I could do in romantic relationships was pick the wrong person. You know, that was my talent, was picking the wrong man. But God really is the perfect matchmaker. And just, you know, I'm just so grateful today for my husband. And I just think that God is continuing to reshape me into someone who has more room for love, more willingness to be useful, and more trust in God. So I think with that, I will pass. Thank you for letting me share. Hello?
Thank you so much, Jessica, for your beautiful presentation this morning. So inspiring and genuine. Thank you for your vulnerability and carrying a message of hope and possibility. Beautiful. Another gem for the archives. Jessica's presentation, the share ID, 22,581. That's 22581 for this morning's presentation. Jessica's contact information will be given at the conclusion of this recording, so do stay tuned for that. And we will now transition to a question and answer segment. You can pose a question to Jessica. We need your first name, including the first letter of your last name, and press star 1 to unmute.
EP.
This is Larry. Okay.
And Larry.
Christina J.
Cheryl L.
Cheryl.
Leland P.
Gotcha, Leland. Star 1 to Gotcha, Judith. Thank you. I have Pete B, Larry K, Christina J, Cheryl L, Leland P, and Judith SP. Anyone else want to get in this group?
It's Marie Ellen G from New York.
I didn't catch your first name.
Marie Ellen.
Marie Ellen. Okay, let's get started. Pete B, you are up.
Thanks, Leah, for taking the meeting. I really appreciate it. And thank you, Jessica. I'm not really bad with my memory these days. But anyway, thank you. It was a very deep and happy presentation. And I appreciate you bringing up the my name is Pete B. I'm a compulsive reader. I'm recovered today by God's grace and mercy. So I appreciate you bringing up the and using the reference in the AA 12 and 12. And I'm just curious about what definition are you using for humility? And do you find what the 12 and 12 talks about humility in step 5, do you find that definition to be consistent with how you're describing it?
Okay, thanks for the question, Pete. So the definition in step 5, is it consistent with how I'm using it? Could you be more specific? Like, is there a specific definition that you're pulling from in the AA 12 and 12?
Yeah, sure. I'm sorry. In step 5, it talks about, I believe it's step 5 in the 12 and 12. I'm not an expert, but it talks about humility, just essentially being, you know, knowing exactly what you are, what we are, no more and no less, plus a desire or an interest in pursuing what we can be.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that tracks for me. Yeah, knowing what I am. I am a compulsive overeater. That is the truth. I mean, I tried to fight that truth. I tried to deny that for so long. And what we can be. I think what you're saying is like God opens up potential for us when we see the truth about ourselves. God opens up potential for us. And I think my perfectionism kept my life and my entitlement kept life really small. It can keep life really small. And definitely my compulsive eating can keep life really small. And I think, you know, God wants us to have an expansive life. He wants us to have an expansive life because we can be more useful that way. And I think like, you know, when I was taking that medication and I felt like it made me a better person. It made me what the world wanted me to be. But that was such a lie. It was such a lie. I feel like it kept me locked in these patterns where I was just really living the same day over and over again. And that's kind of like the food too. I'm just reliving the same day over and over again when I'm in any sort of addiction. And life gets much more interesting. And I guess there's more potential for me to be useful when I'm tapped into God's power. So I hope that helps. I don't know if that answered your question.
Thank you. It does. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thanks, Pete.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Larry K., your turn.
Hey, good morning. Leah, thanks so much for your service. And Jessica, wow. I'll just make the quick comment and then with the under the question that, yeah, and it was great meeting you in Toronto, by the way. You really, for me, I can relate so much. You represent humility to such an extent here because of the authenticity of the presentation and so forth. And I can relate to so much that you shared. So thank you for that. Thank you for being my teacher this morning. Yeah, my pleasure. And so the question, because one of the themes that came through, which I can still relate to, is this perfectionism, and that has kind of mitigated for me as well to some extent. And so I'm just wondering, with perfectionism, is in the context of your relationship with your husband, I'm presuming he's quite the saint. And we tend to meet people like that, right? But anyways, with that, how has your recovery, you know, even bringing perfectionism to relationships and so forth, and then, you know, sort of the authenticity that we want to bring with relationships, right? We want someone to know us, truly know us, and see us intimacy, right? So my question for you is, how has that kind of played out with recovery with your partner and that sort of thing? I don't know if he comes from recovery background. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah. Thanks for the question,
cool,
Larry.
Cool.
Yeah.
Sure.
And it was really great meeting you too, earlier this year. I mean, that's a great question. Again, I talked a lot about, you know, I always wanted to be the smartest person in the room. And it's funny. I was talking to my husband last night and he said to me, he's like, yeah, that's kind of your ethos. You want people to think you're smart. But, and my husband's not in recovery. He's not an addict and in any way at all. He's someone who can really moderate everything. But he's like, he knows so much more than I do about the world. He's way more tapped into current events than I am. Like, he knows more than I do. He just does. It's just a fact, you know, and I have sort of struggled around like my identity in our relationship. I'm not the person who's going to teach him about, you know, all the topics that I think I'm so smart in, because he actually kind of knows more. So I guess, like, I feel like God keeps telling me, like, just to love him. And I wonder, and God's showing me how to be of service. Like, last night our dishwasher broke and he was trying to figure out how to fix it. And I don't know anything about appliances. And so I think God was saying to me, like, just be present while he's there trying to fix it. Like, you don't have to have the answers. You just have to be present and help him feel supported. And I feel like that's the message I keep getting from God nowadays in lots of relationships. Like, I did an inventory about this topic, and, you know, a fellow said to me, like, adults don't need other people to teach them things anymore. It's, you know, they just need someone for them to listen to them and to acknowledge them. And I can make him feel like he's really smart and intelligent. And that's what I try to do nowadays. And I do that imperfectly. But again, like, my whole identity is changing in this program, like, from being someone who's trying to come across as impressive and intelligent to just being someone who's present and loving. So I hope that answers your question.
Thank you, Larry.
Thanks so much.
Christina Jay, you're up.
Good morning, Leah. So good to hear you on the line. I love hearing you on the line. Yeah, Jessica, love you, and was excited to hear that you were going to share. I recently had a great awakening regarding my ego about wanting to change the way people share their what I perceive as hate and, you know, opinions on social media. And especially my spiritual friends, when they post something I perceive as, you know, negative, I suddenly want to, you know, get on a bandwagon and tell them, what are you doing? You know, God's in charge. But I wanted to know if your experience with your mother-in-law, where you wanted her to do something different than she was, or maybe even just what you were explaining about Larry's question, you know, just being acknowledging and loving. If you've been able to transfer that into the extreme turmoil and frustration of people that are, you know, really grappling with what's going on in our world on whatever level. Because really, just what I learned in my 11th step this morning and going to God with this is that I need to be patient, loving, not tolerant, because to me that sounds egotistical. But anyway, the question is, do you find that that's translating into a wider circle of acceptance of just loving and being present for everyone, no matter what their opinion, whatever. They're on a trajectory with God, and I can't change that, and I don't need to, and I don't need to even get into it. So that's my question.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Christina, thank you. That's such a great question, and it's so good to hear you. I think about this a lot. I guess one thing I'll share is, you know, there's this famous comedian who, I don't share his politics. He has a podcast that where he interviews famous people, other famous people. And I have a picture of this comedian at my desk, even though I don't share his politics, but the way that he communicates with people, he does not try to come across as educated or smarter or impressive. He's almost like a child learning from these like experts and, you know, other powerful people. And I guess that has taught me that I have to like check my own assumptions about where people who maybe have different beliefs from me, where they're coming from. And I have to see them as whole people who bring a whole life experience with them that has informed their beliefs, and that their beliefs are coming from a very valid place. Because in something like social media, I can see people, I don't see them as people if I'm disagreeing with whatever is being said. And I'm not taking into consideration a whole lifetime of experience that has led them up to whatever belief that they have. So that really helps me a lot. And I get to see, that's humbling for me, because I can get so entrenched in what I think is right for the world and for other people. That helps me a lot. You know, I don't want to get really dug into my side, because I'm just doing what I think the other side is doing. I hope that makes sense. I guess that's kind of true with my mother-in-law as well. Like, something that happened recently was she texted me and she suggested that I read a book about how to improve my communication skills. And I'm actually, like, my job is a communicator. I'm in corporate communications. And so when someone suggested that I need to improve my communication skills, especially coming from her, I got quite resentful about that. And so I did all the inventory work around that, and I knew I was going to see her, and I expected her to try to give me this book to help, that would help improve my communication skills. And it turns out that I was so wrong. I was so wrong about her intentions, what she meant. She actually said to me, "I think you're a really good communicator, and I hear you do the things that are in this book." So I think that's another, I had to question my own immediate assumptions about her, and see how I was contributing, how I could be contributing to a resentful or a negative dynamic. And again, I have to do that all the time in what's going on in the world. And if I'm in this dystopian mindset about what's happening in the world, then there's no room for God to move and operate when I'm thinking that way. I want to have a mindset where, God is moving and operating in the world. So I hope that helps.
Thank you, Christina J. Cheryl L., your turn.
Good morning. This is Cheryl L. calling from Florida this morning, and so grateful to be on the line. Jessica, thank you so much. I took a lot of notes during your share today. Two things that really stand out for me. One is on perfectionism, of course, and then the other one is on the joy. And because I get one question, I'm going to just ask you if you can speak a little bit to how you try to increase joy in your life. Is it just an attitude, or is it doing things that are joy building? Thank you.
Thank you, Cheryl. I love the question, and it's great to hear you. So I find the more I show up, I try to be guileless is the word, where I don't come in feeling like I have to look or act or be a certain way. That really dismantles my entitlement and my pride, and I'm more able to experience joy. And I think, again, that relationship with God, like believing for so long that God had abandoned me, that nothing good was going to happen to me. So why be happy? Why be joyful? So building that relationship with God, choosing where God is showing up for me, instead of choosing to see where I've been, where God hasn't shown up, or where I've been wronged, or where life doesn't work out, choosing to see where life does work out, where God does show up for me, and focusing my mind there. And I get joy out of that. So it is a mindset for sure. And I think like activities where I, it's funny, doing activities that I am not that good at gives me joy. I like singing. I'm not good at it, but I like it. So I do sing, and I, you know, I'm considering, you know, joining a choir or doing, there's choir nights that you can take part in. And that's really, you know, and like, it's not about performing. It's about being a part of a group and doing something fun as a group. And I'm better at team sports. I really need to be on a team, you know, and I used to think it was about being the lone superstar, but that's not very fun actually for me anyways. Doing things with other people, being useful with other people and allowing myself to be bad at something and not great at it, but having fun anyways. So I hope that helps.
Thank you, Christina L. I'm sorry, Cheryl L. for your question. Leland P., your turn.
Thanks, Leah, and thanks, Jessica. That was a great, great share. It really hit home for me. And I was wondering if there are any specific prayers and meditations or daily practices you do around these topics, humility, perfectionism, and the urgency to convince other people about current affairs.
Yeah. That's such a great question. Thank you, Leland. There is one prayer that I do say quite a bit. It's adapted from a prayer from the faith that I was raised in. And it is it's a prayer for humility. So it says, "Oh God, hear me. From the desire of being esteemed, deliver me. From the desire of being loved, deliver me. From the desire of being extolled, deliver me. From the desire of being honored, deliver me. From the desire of being praised, deliver me. From the desire of being preferred to others, deliver me. From the desire of being consulted, deliver me. From the desire of being approved, deliver me. From the fear of being humiliated, deliver me. From the fear of being despised, deliver me. From the fear of suffering rebukes, deliver me. From the fear of being forgotten, deliver me. From the fear of being ridiculed, deliver me. From the fear of being wronged, deliver me. From the fear of being suspected, deliver me. That others may be loved more than I, grant me the grace to desire it. That others may be esteemed more than I, grant me the grace to desire it. That in the opinion of the world, others may increase and I may decrease. Grant me the grace to desire it. That others may be chosen and I set aside. Grant me the grace to desire it. That others may be praised and I go unnoticed. Grant me the grace to desire it. That others may be preferred to me in everything. Grant me the grace to desire it." Yeah, so that is a prayer that I say often to help reach a state of greater humility.
Thank you, Leon P., for your question. Judith S.P., your turn. Judith S.P., star one to unmute, please.
Hi, this is Judith S.P. in Maryland. Thank you, Leah, for your ongoing service and commitment. And thank you, Jessica, so much. I'll be going back, hopefully, and listening. I was a little bit distracted, but this is a topic that is front and center for me now, pride, humility. And I've heard it often said, and I believe myself, that the greatest distance is between the head and the heart. And conceptually, I have a whole lot of things that I say to myself, or I read about, or hear from others, or even hear from God about living in humility and moving away from pride. And this is an action program. So my question is, do you have, not practices, but actual actions that you take on a moment-to-moment basis to turn, as we say in the big book, this is the turning point, so that I live, even if uncomfortably, in humility and let pride just dissipate over time? And with that, thank you.
Thank you for the question, Judith. It's really good to hear you. I do get on my knees at times. My mother-in-law was here a couple of weekends ago, and, you know, she wasn't following my script. And again, she's a lovely person. There's just something in that relationship where I feel triggered, and I would come in, we were outside, and I would come in and I would come inside the house, and I would go to a place where I didn't think I'd be discovered, and I would get on my knees and I would pray and ask God to help me. I accept that it feels painful, and maybe not painful is the right word, but it's uncomfortable for me at times to practice humility. Like, it feels like the feeling when you do a sharp turn in your car, like that swerve, this inner swerve towards more humility. And so I get a physical feeling from doing that. And I get scared, you know, when I have to say to someone like, well, I don't, you know, if I'm in a work meeting and people are talking about something that I don't know anything about, I sometimes just say like, hey guys, I'm going to be the dumb person in the room and say, I don't know what these terms are that you're saying, using. I don't understand the jargon. Can you help me here? And I've gotten a lot, I do that more often now, and that helps me a lot. That really flattens my ego when I tell on myself that I don't know the answers. I don't know, I don't have the information. And it's actually counterintuitive, like in the world that I'm in, to admit those things. You know, someone would say to me, like, you shouldn't say that, but I do it anyways, because I can't be useful if I'm pretending like I know something I don't know. And I always get a positive response so far anyways. People like to be told that they are the experts. They like to act the expert and school me on what, you know, the things that I need to learn. So I guess I'm giving them an opportunity to do that. So yeah, those things really help, and a lot of prayer. If I'm going into, you know, into a situation where I know my humility will flare up, I definitely pray before I enter that scenario. So thank you for the question.
Thank you, Judith SP. Marie Ellen G. Your turn.
Yes, good morning. Good morning, everyone. This is Marie Ellen G., a recovered compulsive overeater. Jessica, I am so, so grateful to be on the line this morning. I actually haven't been on a Vision and Special Edition in so, so long. So it just makes me remember and say, why aren't you on? So I want to thank you for that. I also want to say that, you know, I am fortunate, you know, to connect with you often, and your humility to me speaks volumes whenever we connect, and today was not an exception. So I really, really want to thank you so, so much. I had so many things that I wrote down, one of the things I wanted to say, for me, this reminds me, this issue for me in terms of character defects and I go to that place that I should have gotten this already. And you spoke to that and saying that this is like a pride issue. And I had someone recently tell me that too, like, what makes you think that you know when
Marie
Ellen, yes.
This is an opportunity for questions, please.
I'm getting to it.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Yes. So my question is, how do you, the feelings that come up when you might think that you should have gotten it already? So I just wanted to see, like, what do you do with those feelings? How best do you handle them if you think that you're doing too many attempts on the same thing? Does that ever happen, and how do you handle it?
Oh, Marie Ellen, thank you so much. So good to hear you. And just really nice to know you're listening. And the question I think was, the area with my mother-in-law where I feel like I should have gotten past these feelings by now, and doing a lot of 10 steps. I guess what I hear God saying to me is like, this is a chance to practice humility. And it's an area that I didn't expect it to be a problem, because up until now, like I've had a lot of challenge in this area around my job. And so this was an area where I didn't expect it to be a problem. I thought it would be easy. I thought having a mother-in-law relationship would be easy. This just runs really deep, and I'm trying to formulate a good answer here, humbly admit. I think God is something about myself that I didn't realize, that was deeper, that runs deeper than the chronic work around and entitlement around my fear. This what's coming up in this mother-in-law relationship runs deeper than that. So I'm seeing how pervasive the disease is, and how I assign roles to people, especially like motherly people, that they're supposed to act a certain way with me, and how I can be really stingy in my love for people. You know, like I want her to give me, to acknowledge me, and I'm not willing. I haven't been willing to do that for her. I have not been willing to do that for her, and I've been stingy in my love for her. So I think God is showing that to me, that I could be more generous and loving with this person, and I can be the one to start. I guess that's another deep thing I had, is I felt like I'm not going to give you love if you don't give it to me first. And I think God is showing, like, you can be the one to start it. You can be the one to start it. And maybe you can do it for a long time before you get it back from the other person. So I think that's what I'm learning. And the step 10s have been so helpful, but definitely I can get into a pattern of I feel like the step 10s, you can just get into this pattern of only dealing with the surface issue, and it'll help me feel better for the day. But then I'm right back where I was the next day in a challenging relationship. And I'm back in myself. So I feel like if I'm doing too many step 10s on something, I might be in myself a lot. So I think it's a lot of practicing, like a lot of step 6 and 7, like I have to just give out the love first to the person who I'm having the challenging relationship. So I hope that helps.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Marie Ellen. We can squeeze in one more question, perhaps two, but let's try at least one.
Sherry,
one, can you?
Yes.
New Jersey.
Who's this?
Mary.
I think there was
Mary
A.
That's New Jersey.
Right. Okay. Sherry A. Let's go with Sherry A. Go ahead with your question, please, Sherry A.
Hi. Good morning, Jessica. Awesome to hear you. Thank you both for your service. So my question real quick is, have you seen a change in how you pray after realizing how pervasive entitlement is? Like, has the things that you pray for changed, or just even how you pray? Thank you.
Thank you, Sherry, for the question. Really, really good to hear you. Yeah, I mean, I think I pray... It used to be that I would pray kind of just in the morning, but I find myself talking to God all day long, more and more. I think, and like you said, the disease is so pervasive. So, I mean, the disease didn't just affect me for 30 minutes in the morning. You know, the disease was woven into my being and my psyche. So praying all as much as I can during the day and talking to God during the day. And I guess, you know, what I ask for in my prayer, I pray for other people. Like, I actually, I applied for a job about a year ago, and this was a recovered job interview experience for me. And someone told me that, you know, pray for the other people applying for this role that you want. Pray for them too. Pray for the person interviewing you. And that, like, wow, what a perspective shift that gave me. And that, something like that really opens up my heart to other people and what they're experiencing. And it definitely gets my focus off myself. And, you know, nowadays, if I'm entering a work meeting where I feel nervous about something, I used to pray for myself and I would ask God to help me. And now I do pray for the other people in the meeting too. I pray for the other people in the meeting too. I find myself praying more for other people, and I just find it just gives me such a sense of peace to do that. So, yeah, I hope that helps. Thank you for the question, Sherry.
Thank you, Sherry A. Hanayeta. We have time to squeeze in another question.
Yes.
Question,
yes.
Please.
And mine's really quick too. First of all, thank you for all of your continued service. And Jessica, thank you so much. Your presentation was really nice, but when you said the prayer, you say, was like, knocked me off my tricycle. And I want to know, my question is, first of all, if I text you on WhatsApp, will you be able to send that to me?
Sure. Yeah, no problem.
And did you really say that by heart? Because that was amazing.
No, I have it in front
of me.
Oh, okay.
And that's pretty incredible, too, that you have it with you all the time. That is so nice. And just how do you stay humble when people are giving you lots of compliments?
I don't get a ton of compliments. I mean, well, I just say thank you, I guess. And I guess it doesn't hit, I don't get the same high off of a compliment that I used to get. So it doesn't cause me to feel the grandiosity that I used to feel. I guess I would be lying if I said that it didn't feel nice to get a compliment, but I don't feel the same, like I said this anguish that I used to carry around with me was so pervasive. And so when something nice would happen or someone would say something nice to me, I would turn that into an idol because I just needed something to get me away from the turmoil. And I don't have it anymore. So I don't crave the compliments as much, and they don't have the same meaning, though it's always nice for someone to say something nice.
Thank you.
So I hope that helps.
That is so awesome. Yes, that's awesome. Thank you.
Thank you, Hanayeta, and everyone else who posed questions this morning. And of course, thank you, Jessica. It's been a delight to spend time with you. Thank you for your humble and powerful presentation this morning. Share ID for today, 22,581. That's 22581 for Jessica's presentation this morning. We're going to close now from page 164. You'll find it in a chapter entitled A Vision for You. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find, and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you.